Ask any education expert what the achievement gap is, and they'll tell you the persistent gap in academic achievements between white and minority students, between affluent and low-income students, between English-speaking and non. Education experts have been researching, analyzing, and probing the causes of this gap for over 30 years now. In fact, one of the major goals of the No Child Left Behind Act was to eliminate the gaps between these different groups of children. And no wonder. This gap, often double digits in test scores, graduation rates, and college completion rates, has disastrous effects that extend far beyond the classroom and schoolyard. The disparity in academic achievement is linked to a variety of problems: lower lifetime earnings, an increased dependence on social services, a higher incidence of crime and imprisonment. Many states determine how many prison cells to build based on the rate at which third graders are reading below grade level. Education professionals have been trying to diagnose and fix this problem for years now. Yet, despite all the studies, the conferences, the reports, despite all the money, resources, and expertise poured into schools, the achievement gap remains. So, in 2007, the communities whose children actually make up the achievement gap came together in forums around the country to talk about the gap as they saw it. They saw a gap that involved more than test scores, and they saw solutions that involved more than schools.
That was the introduction from the recent documentary that was produced last year called No Textbook Answer, Communities Confront the Achievement Gap, that was a partnership between Think TV and the Kettering Foundation. The reason the Kettering Foundation was interested in producing this documentary was because it actually helped illustrate a couple of points that they have found over and over again in their research. One is that when experts name a problem, the community can have a really difficult time getting engaged with the problem and doing anything about it. And the achievement gap is a perfect example of this. The achievement gap is a very technical name for the problem. Education policymakers will know what you mean by it, but when you talk to average people, regular people in everyday communities, even if their kids are the ones who technically are making up the gap, they don't call the gap that. Very few parents, unless they were super, super engaged, would ever recognize that as the name of the problem. It's more a problem that education policymakers and teachers would use to describe the problem. But if only education professionals and policymakers and teachers are using that to describe the problem, then the community's not having a conversation about it at all. The community doesn't even recognize that name, and they certainly don't see anything that they could do. They don't talk about it, they don't see anything they could do about it, and they don't take any action on it. So it was a really good example of that. When the community actually talks about the achievement gap, when you explain what exactly was meant, the gap in test scores between black and minority and white students, between affluent and poor, between rural and inner city and suburban, when you explain that to them, they could kind of see what you were talking about, but they actually saw it as being being a lot of gaps, not one big huge gap, but just lots of little gaps, and not necessarily gaps that had anything to do with not all the gaps had a lot to do with the schools. So another point from Kettering Foundation's research that illustrated was that solving the achievement gap, being a kind of fixing education, is not actually a technical problem. It's not a problem that a policymaker or a professional can really fix. It's not something that can be fixed from top down. It's not a technical problem with an answer for how you do it. It's a political problem. It involves, and not political in terms of political parties or anything like that, but small p politics. Just, it requires people coming together and making a decision together about what needs to be done and then working together to be able to implement that. That's what actually is required for education to get better and for the achievement gap to be closed. While certainly there are many things that, from a top-down solution that could help, you know, a national policy on education, universal national standards, maybe a different funding model, whatever people want to do, those top-down solutions could probably help, but they wouldn't be able to solve the problem on their own because it's not a technical problem with a specific best practice that can just eliminate it. It has to be solved by communities. So how Kettering found out about this was that in 2007, people held forums around the country And we actually decided to go back and visit seven of these places and talk to them about the experience that they'd had in the forums. And what they talked about was that, as I said, when they were discussing the achievement gap, they saw many gaps. They saw in various places poverty, uninvolved parents, or parents who had maybe not had the best experience with school themselves, so they had a difficult time navigating it with their children again. White flight, lack of role models in communities, English language learners, a high percentage of those that can make it more difficult for a school to make the adequate yearly progress that people want for them, low expectations by students themselves, by parents, by teachers, by the community at large. So, and the thing that was interesting, though, was that a lot of times when you hear this problem, the achievement gap talked about, people talk about it like it's this national blight, it's this national problem, and it's kind of pretty much the same everywhere. But when people talked about it, they saw it as having usually specifically local causes. Some of the problems showed up in various locations. For instance, we went to Helena, Arkansas, Mobile, Alabama, Panama City, Florida, Bridgeport, Connecticut, Cincinnati, Ohio, Minneapolis, Minnesota, and a number of other places. And we saw that a lot of people said similar things, that it was poverty was a problem because there was not much of an economy for kids to be motivated to join into when they got done with school, because the economy in their town wasn't thriving. There wasn't any money for parents to provide extra funding for the schools or more educational opportunities outside of schools. Poverty came up in a lot of places. So did low expectations. But people did not necessarily see these as, again, being a national thing. They thought that the poverty in their community or the low expectations in their community were also caused by something that was local, and that necessarily only they locally could use the resources they had to combat those problems. And so it didn't seem to, and so what all the communities that talked together recognized was that there was only so much that help from the top could do. But what was really necessary was for them to realize what they saw the problems as being, what they saw the gaps as being, and what they as a community thought that they could do to help fill those gaps. And when they did talk about those, and when they talked about it this way, they did see a role for themselves. They didn't just think, well, this is entirely a school problem, or this is entirely a problem of funding, or anything like that. They started to realize that certainly some of the problems were in the schools, but not all of the problems that were in the schools. And sometimes some of the problem was that the schools were trying to cope with everything, when in fact there are certain gaps that only parents, individuals, citizens working together, or communities as a whole can fill. So when they decided to talk about these problems this way, they talked about what they saw as being the gaps and what they saw as being possible solutions that they could put into practice on their own without waiting for federal grant money or, you know, some big educational organization to come to town and tell them kind of what to do. And depending on what different communities saw as being their problems, they took action based on the conversations that they had in these forums. A lot of people said that that the path to college was really difficult because many parents hadn't navigated. So they had parent college weekends where parents went out onto college campuses and learned about what it would take to get their kids into a public versus a private college, what the experience would be like, what tuition might be like, just what kind of experience would be best for their kid, how they could best get scholarships or federal aid. The federal application for student aid was also something that people could use a lot of help understanding how to figure out. Parents found it really helpful if they and their child together could be helped to make it through this form, because that is such a huge part of continuing after college. But again, most of the focus, a lot of times people notice this has to start much earlier than college. So there was a lot of focus on what could be done earlier, pre-K through 12. So they would do things like certain communities would partner, churches would get together, and they would put together backpacks for students who couldn't afford all the school supplies they needed, sometimes even with like clothes and things, so that kids would have everything they needed to feel okay at school and do well at school and take advantage of the educational opportunities that they did have. One of the problems, though, that they recognized in many places, again, though, was that educational opportunities in school are one thing, and that's fine, but one thing that can really separate an enriched academic experience for a kid where they're automatically going to go on to college, you can almost just assume that they will, is that they have lots of educational opportunities outside of school. In certain school districts, you're going to go to school, but on the other hand, if you don't do particularly well in a subject, you're going to get a tutor, you'll get some kind of enriched opportunities. After school, you'll have music or arts practice, or you'll play a sport or have an internship, something else that is providing you extra social capital that's going to make you a very attractive candidate for higher education. There's not nearly this many opportunities in a lot of places. That was a big problem that people recognized. But they had to think, well, what can we do? You know, again, without necessarily waiting for, you know, a big grant for it so we can create a huge program from scratch. What can we do with what we have here, and what can we do to fill these gaps and create more opportunities for people? So we saw people who, concerned citizens who arranged internship programs for kids to work with, to work in local businesses so that they could put that on their resume, put that on their college applications and say that they had this opportunity. Or arts classes at community centers or in other places besides the schools, sponsored by churches or by citizens groups or, you know, small nonprofits within various communities. Minneapolis did a lot of this, but there was also quite a bit of focus on this in many other places that we saw. And then there were lots of other activities with especially mentoring and tutoring. Lots of churches in various communities across the country really got together to help kids with their homework after schools and to provide mentoring and role models for kids, because they said that that many times had a lot to do with the low expectations that students had for themselves. And that's not to say that there weren't still things that even a government could do, sometimes even like local government. For instance, you know, local governments, local municipalities, when they saw citizens getting engaged on this, sometimes the citizens reached out to their local governments to see what they could do to help also come at this problem. And they started looking into things like rezoning districts so they would have a mix of students so that there wouldn't be this kind of informal segregation where all minorities are in one school district and all the, you know, non-minority students are in another, or they're not segregated strictly by class. So they considered rezoning options and different options for teacher retention, pay and things and other incentives like that. So all these communities held these forums, talked about the gaps, talked about what they could do, put these things into action. And what the documentary was about was going to these different places and seeing what occurred from that. And basically, I would say that three themes really came out from all the communities. One was that more money alone wouldn't solve the problem. While most people said that more money for certain things would help, maybe some more money for schools, maybe some more money for, you know, outside of school programs, more money alone wouldn't solve the problem, because this isn't a problem that money can solve. And this is an argument that makes a lot of sense to people this is something that people can get caught on when they talk about, you know, not wanting to reward failing schools. The money can really complicate the issue, and people will point to the fact that it's even mentioned in the documentary. You know, there are lots of failing schools that are in brand new buildings, and there are all kinds of money and expertise being thrown at it, you know. But the problem is not necessarily right in the schools. A lot of times the problems can be in the community or in the home, and there's nothing really that the school can do about those problems. The community has to see and be engaged and decide that they're going to do something about the problems that they themselves have identified. That's actually pretty much the second finding, which was, and we just heard this everywhere we went, it takes a village. But the point is, I think, that people were also trying to make was not just this feel-good thing of, oh, it takes everybody. It does, but it takes a working village. It takes a village where people can actually talk together about these problems, in a productive way, you know, not get caught up in polarization and name-calling and blaming, but also talk together in a productive way and then decide to take action together in a productive way. People that know the different assets that they have in their communities, people that are able to find those and access them and work with them to get something done, that's a necessary part of it too. And so all these communities that found that it did take a village and that they needed to have the entire community involved, found though that what necessarily those communities would accomplish would be different in every case. That there was, and this is the title of the documentary, that there was no textbook answer for what each community should do about this. Every community had to talk together about where they saw the problem coming from, what they thought would be the best way to address that problem, and then they had to find the assets and the resources in their community that they wanted to use to try to combat it. And this was necessarily different in every place, but because the solutions that these people came up with for their communities were developed by themselves, they definitely had more buy-in than any kind of top-down policy solution. No matter how, you know, supported by expertise, supported by best practice, supported by the literature, no matter what, these kinds of solutions had a lot more buy-in, and they actually, had notable effect in many places. There was a lot of significant activity already, even in places that had only started these forums fairly recently. Towards the end of the documentary, we go visit a place called Mobile, Alabama. Everybody's heard of Mobile, Alabama. But this particular community of Mobile, Alabama has actually been doing this work for over 30 years. And over that long period of time, they have shown significant results. It's another kind of statement that this work is not something that can just be done in a really rapid way. It's not something that you can just immediately point to and say, well, just do this and this will fix your problem. It a lot of times does take a long time to work. But over the 30 years that Mobile has put into this work, they now have a school system that is strong and that can make strides to improve based just strictly because it wants to, and not necessarily because they're having to respond to any kind of immediate crisis. No matter who they're at this point, the community is so united around what they're doing for education and what the community's goals are and how the community is intent on making those happen, that it doesn't matter if they get a weird school board member or an odd school superintendent who doesn't necessarily come in having those same goals. The school superintendent is forced to be responsive to what the community wants, because that's how strong they are. They are completely engaged, which was another finding of the documentary, which was that even if the problem was in the schools, and that's not to say that there aren't very often problems within the schools, problem within the funding models for schools, all those problems did exist in many of these communities, but that even if the problem was in the schools, that becoming the kind of engaged community that you become when you talk together about how to solve a problem, that was also the best way to hold schools accountable for what they were accomplishing within the time that they have with kids. So now that the documentary has been produced, it was produced in 2011, and it's actually airing on public and college and university television stations around the country. The reason that Kettering Foundation was interested in supporting this documentary was not to document best practices, but to show the kind of conversations that a community has to have before they can do the kind of work that only they can do, the kind of work that is absolutely necessary to getting the kind of community buy-in and action that's necessary to fill those gaps. Conversations like this, people have used the documentary to start conversations just like the ones that you can see in the film in Maryland, in Grand Rapids, Michigan, not to mention all the places that held the original forums. We've been thinking that there's so much concern in Dayton over the state of public education, maybe Dayton could be next.